Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it is time for Q&A with Layla, a very special pre-holiday edition of Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. A very Merry Christmas, because, well, Christmas is upon us. It's hard to believe, but here it is. Time flies when you're having fun. Today, we're with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin, who is a registered dietitian. She also has earned a master's degree in the field of nutrition. We work together daily at the Hoffman Center with patients, and we're here together on a weekly basis to answer your questions. You can send us questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com, and give us, it seems like we have about a month's lag. So if you don't hear an answer to your question in a month, don't give up. It's just that we get a lot of questions. Try to answer as many as we can.
We do, and we thank you for all these wonderful questions and comments.
Yeah, very thought-provoking questions from many of our listeners. So so how are you doing? Gearing up for the holidays?
I'm okay.
Yeah?
I'm ready. Oh, my gosh, but it's like, you know, the last time I blinked, it was August.
Exactly.
Or so it seems.
That's pretty crazy. So
it's going awfully quick.
Yeah, things are going quick. So you sent me an email earlier today about something that you wanted me to take a look at, which is the psychobiotic revolution. I think that was the title.
Yeah,
so what's up with that?
This is a presentation given by Dr. John Cryon from the University College of Cork in Ireland at the National Institutes of Health. And it's the microbiome as key regulator of mood.
Wow.
Of psychological well-being and all of that. And it was very, very informative. It was an hour long. He talked about some different strains of, you know, lactobacillus bifidobacterium, among so many other taxa of bacteria, and how, you know, the whole gut-brain connection. And I know this is something that you and I have talked about in presentations and food and mood and all of that, and it's being looked at even more deeply now by neuroscientists, which is very, very exciting.
Mm-hmm. And I actually have a story to complement that, which is I just learned of a Cambridge biotech startup. You know, maybe, investors get ready because this may be the next Genentech, but you never know. It could also crash and burn. It's a small, nimble startup that's capitalized the tune of maybe a few million dollars. It's called Ceres Therapeutics. It's spelled S-E-R-E-S. And they are developing, they're getting into ecobiotic drugs. Okay, we've heard of antibiotics. We've heard of probiotics and prebiotics. These are ecobiotic drugs. And
Oh my goodness.
The reason they call them drugs is because they're actually going, they're not going to be sold in health food stores. Otherwise, they couldn't be drugs, right? They're going through an FDA approval process for, I think they've got different types of probiotics that are functional probiotics. One is designed to reverse C. difficile, which is that very tenacious diarrhea condition that's very hard sometimes to treat even with powerful antibiotics. And sometimes you require fecal transplants for it. Well, fecal transplants are a little icky, so they're saying maybe, just maybe, we'll put it in a pill and this will help people to recover. Also, they're targeting inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, with another experimental formula.
Wow.
And again, these are the live organisms, I think. That's what this is about.
Uh-huh.
And finally, they haven't undertaken very extensive testing yet, but they have on the drawing board something for metabolic syndrome. In other words, a probiotic that will help to restore diversity and functionality in the gastrointestinal tract to create a healthy microbiome that favors normal metabolism over pre-diabetic insulin resistance. How about that? That's pretty cool.
You're talking about almost half the American population.
Right.
With wow. Okay.
Okay. So, we hope that we're going to follow this company very closely. But I think there's kind of a new space race going on here when it comes to the microbiome. And between natural products companies and high-tech companies, that's where the money is in terms of modifying disease risk. So I think very exciting that we predicted this for a long time, talking about it, and finally science and practical application has caught up with it.
Yeah. Wow. Very, very, very exciting. I wanted to give a shout-out to Gail, who sent this very nice email. Dear Dr. Hoffman, thank you for your newsletter on the 28 things to be thankful for. That's the article you wrote, Dr. Hoffman, for the Thanksgiving newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And Gail says, I would just like to add number 29, and that is you for all the great info you provide to all of your listeners. I'm an avid follower of yourself and Layla, and I'm most thankful for all that you do. Wishing you a happy, healthy day. Thank you, Gail.
Yeah, we're very appreciative
very
of comments
nice.
Like that, and it just makes it all worthwhile. So, well.
And then on the other hand, we've got another comment. We've got two comments about the same topic from Jean and also from Joe. You know, Dr. Hoffman, you often recommend xylitol for oral health, the Spry chewing gum product.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jean and also Joe in separate emails are warning us that we should let people know that if anybody is a pet owner, if they have dogs and their dogs have bad breath, that they should not give them the xylitol gum.
Right.
Because it can be poisonous to dogs.
Yeah, we've done that warning before, but I think it's important to emphasize that things that are good for humans aren't necessarily good for animals. I think an example of which is chocolate. You know, humans can consume a lot of chocolate, and they're okay. Maybe they get a, you know, expanded waistline, but dogs have kind of a low capacity for chocolate. But xylitol is not well metabolized by animals. It can cause fatal, I think, kidney damage. I think that's the way it works in dogs.
Wow.
So, and I think you really have to keep anything that's toxic that may have an attractive aura about it away from dogs. I've heard of episodes of dogs eating glue. They get into glue and they, you know, they bite open the containers and they, you know, it has some, I guess, a little bit of a sweet taste or something. And they swallow that and they get, basically they glue their insides together. And this can be very catastrophic. It requires emergency surgery. And
that's
so you want to just kind of keep, you know, your pets are like little, you know, little toddlers, you know, they'll get into everything.
know?
And so you want to kind of keep everything at maybe a high shelf level that they could possibly get into, because otherwise you may have a catastrophe on your hands.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, thank you, Jean and Joe, for mentioning that.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got a question from Billy. And Billy says, blood thinners like Xarelto, he wants to know, how does that work in the setting of somebody who takes vitamin K? Should you avoid taking vitamin K when you're taking that new blood thinner, Xarelto? Dr. Hoffman, isn't that the new blood thinner that does not have an antidote?
Well, actually, there's an update on that, is they are developing antidotes to Xarelto and similar medications. These are alternatives to Coumadin. When people prefer not to take Coumadin, which is tough to take because you have to keep monitoring it and you can't take any vitamin K or too much in the way of foods that contain vitamin K because that will antagonize it. That doesn't happen with Xarelto and similar drugs. However, that while it's an advantage to some extent, it has been a disadvantage because once, let's say you have to have emergency surgery and they want to stop the anticoagulant effects quickly, or say you have a bleed and you want to reverse the anticoagulant effects, it's, until recently, it's been hard to do that. With Coumadin, you can just administer vitamin K.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about, because they have different mechanisms of action, you can take as much vitamin K as you want when you're taking Xarelto. It just has no impact whatsoever in your clotting. And this is actually one of the things that I wrote about in X number of things that your doctor doesn't know about nutrition but should. Many doctors recommend that patients who are on blood thinners like aspirin or Xarelto who've had maybe some higher risk of blood clots, not take vitamin K because they believe the vitamin K causes blood clots. It doesn't cause blood clots unless you're on Coumadin. where it will not cause a blood clot. It'll simply reverse the blood thinning effects of the Coumadin, but it won't reverse blood thinning effects of aspirin or other types of blood thinners. So,
and besides,
very valuable, because the very same people who are taking these blood thinners usually have cardiovascular disease, and vitamin K2, we know, especially the MK2, the MK7 fraction of it, is helpful for two conditions that affect the elderly: cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis. So, you know, denying them the vitamin K, that's not good.
No, no, not at all. So, all right. Billy, thank you very much for your question. We've got a question here from Dara. She writes, my aluminum level has gone up from 4 in July of this year to 15 in November. What could be the cause of this? I do not have aluminum pans, but do use aluminum foil. Mm-hmm. Also, I've been drinking a lot of yerba mate herbal drinks. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned because of the Alzheimer's connection. Is there a way I could lower my aluminum level?
Okay. Let's first explore the Alzheimer's aluminum connection. It's the, in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease are found what are called fibrillary tangles, which are amyloid plaque deposition areas and basically damaged, tangled up nerve debris, which signals the destruction, literally, of the tissue in the brain. And mixed up in that often are unusually high amounts of aluminum. Now, does that mean that the aluminum is the cause of the Alzheimer's disease? There is a model for aluminum dementia, which used to occur in dialysis patients when they ran the dialysis filtration units with a lot of aluminum. And the aluminum would get into the brains of these dialysis patients, and it would promote dementia. And I think probably any heavy metal, lead, cadmium, mercury, aluminum, even iron overload can be damaging to the brain. There's all these factors that may predispose to Alzheimer's. Actually, there's a new theory, and it was a very, very impressive article about the relationship between fungal infections in the brain and Alzheimer's. That's a fascinating connection. And, you know, that sounds crazy, but it very legitimate research found a high percentage of biopsy specimens from Alzheimer's patients had traces of fungal residues in the brain. Now, the question is, did the fungus cause the Alzheimer's, or does Alzheimer's permit, it kind of maybe lowers the defenses of the brain and permits all kinds of debris to be
deposited,
to accumulate in the brain because maybe the brain's self-cleaning mechanisms are impaired. We don't know.
But you bring up an interesting point. Something I remember, we were talking with another neurologist at one time here in the office, and we were talking about how in Alzheimer's, it's not the beta amyloid plaques that they should not be present. It's just that they're not being cleared properly because the beta amyloid plaques are part of the metabolism of the brain, and the lack of clearing it properly is the hallmark of Alzheimer's. And maybe the same mechanism is what's causing that additional debris, the toxic metal like aluminum or anything, to accumulate. That's very interesting.
But let's, you know, that we're sort of
we're hypothesizing.
we're looking at the rationale for the question. But let's, for argument's sake, let's assume that the mercury is potentially an issue. So, what are some things to potentially avoid that are environmental sources of mercury? Well, we know, for example, that if you use aluminum pots and pans, and you especially put acidic things, you make like tomatoes or something in there, that can leach some of the aluminum.
And when you're using aluminum pans that are not anodized, when they're anodized, they're safer, and you want to make sure that your utensils are also anodized. You don't want to use an aluminum spatula in an aluminum pot or a pan, because then you're getting bits and shards and scrapes. They're microscopic, but we're still ingesting them. Mm-hmm. And not using aluminum foil in your cooking is a good idea.
Right.
That would be another thing.
And then there's other sources. There's aluminum in most deodorants, most antiperspirants. Let's put it this way. Most antiperspirants. It's because they're things that kind of put a fragrance under your arms. But the most effective antiperspirants are aluminum compounds. And then you put them in an area that's where the skin is thin, where there are pores, and the result can be absorption of mercury into your, I mean, of aluminum into your system. So, and there are plants literally that accumulate mercury. You know, some mercury
aluminum.
Comes to us. Yeah, aluminum. I keep saying mercury.
There are
plants that accumulate aluminum.
It's in the soil.
Yeah.
You know, so many plants will pull them up. We have to be aware of that. Dara also mentions that she drinks a lot of varied herbal drinks, maybe some yerba mate. I would question the source. I mean, depending on what part of the world it's coming from, possibly more contamination, more pollution, or anything like that.
And by the way, what's our take on yerba mate tea?
I don't know. I don't have an opinion.
You know, it's
really one way or the other.
Basically, it's another source of caffeine. I mean, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's in South America. It's one of the major dietary sources of caffeine because it is a caffeinated beverage.
Mm.
It's a stimulant.
Yeah. So that could be something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm assuming when Dara says her aluminum level went from a 4 to a 15, it's probably a blood test.
Yeah.
Which is also very telling because if it's spilling into the blood, that's quite a higher number.
But for accuracy's sake, we often use what's called a provoked chelation, where we use a challenge and then we see how much spills into the urine. And in some ways, a more accurate test because you might seem normal on a regular blood test, but then on a provoked urine test, it might push more out of your tissue and show that you have a higher level than you suspect.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about chelation as a way of getting this stuff out. I recently read an article, I don't know, it was a major magazine article, big expose about the town of Flint, Michigan. That is, you know, it's an old industrial area where certainly they had a lot of automobile manufacture, battery manufacture, and there's a lot of lead in the water sources. And the inhabitants of Flint, Michigan have shown an alarmingly high level of lead. So I'm reading the article, all kinds of problems associated with that, kidney problems, high blood pressure, brain problems, higher risk of dementia, higher risk of attention deficit disorder, mental retardation, blah, blah, blah. Read the entire article, like, you know, 5 pages long. It's not one single mention of chelation therapy as a way of getting rid of that. You know, so I don't know. That's
too bad.
Too bad. I mean, certainly very important to make sure everybody has clean water, clean air, clean food. But once, you know, invariably we get exposed to these things, especially those of us who grew up in the 50s and 60s, before they had very stringent controls about lead in paint and lead literally in gasoline. They had leaded gasoline. And so, you know, a lot of patients who come to see me, they say, well, where did I get all that lead, you know, when I do the test?
Yeah.
And because I'm not using any, you know, leaded materials. And if the person is 60 or 70, I say, hey, guess what? Where were you before 1966 when there was leaded gasoline in cars? You absorb the lead. Probably most of it got stored in your bones. If you're a woman, especially, but also men do this to some extent, you're losing bone, and the calcium goes out in your urine. But some of the lead gets exposed in your bloodstream.
Deposited into the bone?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It comes out of the bone because the bone, you have less bone. Maybe you have 30% less bone than when you were 35 years old. You have thinner bone. So that bone bank is giving up its lead repositories. And all of a sudden, later in life, at the very time when you need to safeguard against dementia, because lead can increase your risk, cardiovascular disease, you're seeing higher levels of lead, even though you haven't been exposed. It's old lead. It's, you know, lead from the 50s.
Yeah. Wow.
It's wild.
Because it doesn't really hang out in the bloodstream. It gets stored into our skeleton, our muscles, our brains, our organs, all that. It needs to be provoked out. And that's why the urine test is so much more informative. What do you think of oral chelation for a level like this?
Oral chelation is actually not bad for, it's slow. It's not as dramatically effective as intravenous EDTA chelation for lead. But there's something that we use called DMSA or Captomer that actually chelates out some mercury and lead. and it's prescription medication. It has to be prescribed by a doctor. You can't buy in a health food store. And it sort of works. It takes a while. I mean, for our patients who are in the process of doing that, it takes 2-3 years to see levels decline to acceptable levels.
Well, I would recommend to Dara not using aluminum foil anymore in cooking, at the very least.
Check your deodorant ingredients and check your cosmetic ingredients. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what's our next question?
Our next question comes from Judy. Judy writes, "Doctor, I love your show and learn a lot. Do you have any suggestions for a 39-year-old female with low energy?"
Well,
that's a podcast.
Yeah, unfortunately, you asked that question towards the end of our part one. So let's actually reserve that question for part two of today's podcast.
Okay.
We divide these podcasts into two parts. So when we return, we'll talk about some of the considerations. Do we have any more information on this individual, or is it just sort of I'm 39 and I have low energy?
That's all.
Okay. Well, and
let's
explore some of the possibilities in part two of our discussion. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.